This is Neil Whiteside. Cambridge 105
Radio. Now, as we know in the past, Neil's diary is less than accurate at times. It consists of a file of facts and a pencil, and sometimes I write the wrong things in. I was expecting two people here at the studio this afternoon. I was expecting Morgan Bell, who's the assistant curator at our charity of the month, the Museum of Technology. But I think we may have got that slightly wrong, so just check my emails, and it doesn't mention her at all. So, good afternoon to you, Morgan, if you're listening down at the museum. But it's a real pleasure to welcome into the studio Roger Crabtree from the Pie History Trust. Roger, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Neil.
Lovely to have you in. Because now, there is a great link between the Museum of Technology and the Pie History Trust, and we'll come on to that in a second. But first off, tell us a little bit about the Pie History Trust, because it's a name synonymous with Cambridge, isn't it?
It is indeed. Well, a group of five of us are now together. We're researching the history of pie. We're working, obviously, as you know, with the Museum of Technology to mount a permanent exhibition of pie products, together with Cambridge Scientific Instruments as well. Mm-hmm. We're there because we think that there were important technological companies in Cambridge way before the so-called Cambridge phenomenon started in the 60s with your Acorns and Cambridge Computers and Sinclairs of the world. And we, and in pie, and Marshalls and Cambridge Scientific Instruments were there 60 plus years before that, and certainly our company, Pi, had many groundbreaking happenings over those 60 years, and we wanted really to put them back on the record, if you like, as being a significant Cambridge presence for those years. I mean, we reckon that in 1960 there was something like 8,000 Pi employees working either in Cambridge or within a 20-mile radius of Cambridge.
That is staggering, because the size of the population of Cambridge at the time, obviously much less than it was now. That's
made
a
it
huge
by
employer,
by far the biggest private employer in the town, in the city. As
and there were so many sites, weren't there?
Well, that's right. We're actually here today in Gwydir Street. There was a pie site when I joined in 69 here in Gwydir Street.
Yes. Now, can you tell us what it was?
It was the spares department of Pie Telecommunications. It had about 35 employees and a warehouse with lots of spares in it. And we sent those spares out to our customers or to our service engineers across the UK. And this was where it was housed.
Well, how lovely that there's a radio station still sat here where a little remnant of pie. We should have a logo on the wall or something and change our name to pie.
It was actually just across the yard, I have to say.
Was it?
Not in this particular building, but it's in the yard anyway.
It was here.
Right here, and I visited it many times over the years. Yeah.
And, of course, so many of the landmarks, of course, the Newmarket road sites, they have all gone.
Well, you name it, they're all practically all housing estates now.
They are, aren't they? So what happened? I mean, you're putting together a history of the company, and presumably you've managed to keep some of the products that they made, because when they dismantle factories, there is this habit of chucking everything in a skip, isn't there?
Absolutely. And we kind of wish we'd thought about all this 40 years ago and 30 years ago, and we'd have got much more than they've got now. But we have acquired quite a range of products, actually, certainly enough to house the objects we can put into the museum. Maybe one or two more acquisitions, but in the main, we've got more products than we can actually show at this moment in time.
Right, that's going to beg the question, of course, what do you choose? But going right back to the start of the story of pie, it started in one way, and then in came, was it Charles Orr Stanley, C.O. Stanley,
He's the main man,
and he
yes.
changed, he was a bit of a maverick character, wasn't
well,
he?
He was, yes. So, yes, it all started in 1896 when William George Pye, W.G. Pye, left the Cavendish Labs. He was an instrument maker and set up his own business. It was a kind of an early example of outsourcing, because he actually had the Cavendish Labs as his main customer. And he continued with that until after the First World War, when the market kind of fell away a bit. And his son, Harold, suggested maybe we should get into this newfangled thing called wireless, because it was not till 1922 that the BBC first started broadcasting. Mm-hmm. And so Pye was into radio at the very beginning. But then 6 years later, I think WG felt he was really an instrument maker at heart and not sure about this wireless stuff. And in came this guy, C.O. Stanley, who was the advertising agent for Pye. And he bought the company, basically. I mean, it's an amazing story. He was actually trying to get Philips in Holland to buy the company. And they were, WG wanted £60,000 for it. And C.O. Stanley, always known as C.O., by the way,
right.
He tried to broker this deal and said to Phillips, well, I can get you it for £60,000, but I want £5,000 commission. Phillips balked at that and said, no, thank you very much. So CO decided he would buy Pi, or the radio bit of Pi.
Right.
But he didn't have any money. So he went down to London with this radio and convinced a bank manager in London to lend him £5,000 so that he could then put the deposit down with WG to buy the company. He then did that, and a year later, he then put Pi on the market and raised £160,000.
Good Lord.
So he then paid off the £55,000 that he was owing and ended up with a real profit and owned the company.
How amazing.
That's typical of CEO's entrepreneurial spirit.
Spotting a hole in the market. Like, you can understand kind of why WG wasn't quite so interested, because instrument making is a very accurate thing for a very distinct market, whereas he was trying to appeal to the masses with radio receivers and things.
Yeah, that's right. And into television, into the 30s, of course, that was starting to be developed, and he was very early into that as well. So he had this vision of where the market was going.
Yeah. And then, of course, along came the war, and that changed things. He got into communications at that point.
And radar. Well.
And radar.
Yeah, it was certainly groundbreaking stuff in radar, yes, and military communications, yeah, both of those. So Pi played I think the expression is Pi had a good war.
And that story sort of still goes, that theory still goes on today, doesn't it? Yeah. We'll look ahead to what also happened, because the story of Pi after that, it moved on and on and on, and what exactly is going to be at the Museum of Technology. Cambridge 105 Welcome back. My studio guest this afternoon is Roger Crabtree of the Pi History Trust. And just before we went into the travel there, Roger, we were talking about the early days or into the war days of Pi and Pi Telecoms, as it became. You mentioned right at the start that there was this deal on the go to sell to Philips in Holland. And eventually he did do that, didn't he? It did get sold to Philips.
Yes, it did indeed in 1966, or 67 actually, to be precise. By then, CEO Stanley had been kind of ousted, if you like. He was the boss of Pi for nigh on 40 years. But
wow.
I think probably in the later years, technology was becoming more complex. The market was becoming tougher. The Japanese were coming in with their televisions and all the rest of it. And maybe he just lost a little bit of his spark, if you like. But anyway, and there were certain financial problems in the group. He lost his job, and his son, who was the deputy chair, was booted out at the AGM of Pi in 1966. And then there was a takeover battle between Thorn Industries and Philips of Holland for the control of Pi, which eventually Philips won, and they took 51% of the shares of Pi at that time. The British government didn't want a major British electronics company wholly foreign-owned, so they kept 49% of the shares on the open market. And then over the years, gradually, Philips acquired more and more shares, so in effect, the full takeover took place some sort of 13 years later, and Pi moved to being called Philips rather than Pi. And then Philips itself stretched far too wide across a vast array of electronic products, decided they had to specialise, and then most of the ex-Pi companies disappeared in the contraction of Philips to a few core businesses, which weren't to do with the things that we did in Cambridge, really.
Right. Now, you said there about a few of the Pi companies, and I've seen a talk of yours before. There was a real maze of suppliers and manufacturers. That must have been half the problem, half the battle, keeping that all working together.
Right. I mean, that was one of the issues for CEO, I suppose, in terms of his later years, because he'd got... it got a series of what we called A companies, which were the consumer product side, telecommunications, television transmission, and he'd actually bought back WG Pi for 20 years after WG gone off on his own. So there was a scientific instruments aspect to it. And then there was a myriad of small companies which were mainly making components to supply to the big companies and to the third party market. There were, you know, for example, three in Newmarket. There was Cathode and Crystals in Linton. Several of these. One of the interesting things happening in the war is that Pye was under pressure to move to Wales because it was vulnerable to being bombed.
Ah, right.
And CO said, it's Pye of Cambridge, not Pye of Swansea. And what he did is he set up village industries where assemblies were done in church halls and all sorts of places. Wow. Out in the fens. A workforce in total of some 14,000 people in the war did all these sub-assemblies and then got them into Cambridge to make the finished products.
That's quite forward-thinking, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And then after the war, several of these sites became these little companies.
Right.
And many more of those 14,000 were also bussed into Cambridge. That's one of the things I inherited in 69, was something like 1,200 people coming in from all over the fens, as far as Wisbeach, on a fleet of 25 buses to work in Pye in Cambridge. How? Which is an interesting facet of the story.
That is, that you're actually having to bring your people in like that.
Yeah. Well, there was no employment in the fens for females other than pretty tough summer labour in the field. Mm. So a steady job undercover with transport provided was pretty attractive to a lot of people in the fens, particularly the ladies, because the assembly was intricate work where you really need high dexterity, and women are frankly a lot better than men are. And many other things as well, of course.
indeed. And it's in common with so many of the other companies, the big companies that were around at that time. There was a real family atmosphere, wasn't it? It was always the holidays and the trips away.
That's right, we had the annual outings. That's right. And it was very family oriented. I mean, C.O. Stanley had his son and his brother and his sister working for the group, and that kind of took the lead. I met a couple of years ago doing some of the interviews with a lady who came from India along with her three sisters and her brother and her mum and dad in the early 60s. All of them worked for Pye.
My goodness me. That just sums it up then. So it's obviously a good employer to work for.
It wasn't paid the best, but it had good conditions, and we looked after people, we trained them well. Mm. And it was a pretty happy atmosphere. People used to sing on the lines, bring their records in and have them play.
Oh, my goodness me.
Yeah.
Only if it was on the Pye record label, of course.
Well, of course.
So moving on then, it's no longer around, and this Pye History Trust has been founded. So you're moving into a newly created space at the Museum of Technology.
Yes.
So what's the plans for this?
Well, first of all, can I say we're just delighted to be working with the Museum of Technology. I think we've helped them because they have got this, as I'm sure you've heard, this large heritage lottery grant. Mm. And I think the fact that they were partnering somebody like us probably helped that bid somewhat. Yeah. So it's sort of mutual agreement that this is a good way to go forward. We have, sadly, of course, a relatively limited space. I mean, we would like 5 times as much ideally, but at least we've got what we've got, so that's perhaps the important thing. So we're now really stuck into stuff we don't know much about, like is how do you actually plan an exhibition, exactly which objects will go how and how they go into the cabinets, writing panels and labels and timeline stuff and finding photographs to go with them, everything. It's a pretty busy but exciting time because the end is finally just about in sight. The museum are hoping to open at Easter next year. And so, you know, we're working pretty hard to try and make sure we've done our bit in it.
I can imagine after all these years of planning that suddenly now, oh my goodness, we've actually got to start and choose the bits of a kit and everything, get it all cleaned up. Will you have an option to rotate stuff? Will you be able to change the display at all?
Yes. I think in the fullness of time, we're also hoping at the time of the opening we might mount a temporary exhibition in the sort of space in the middle of which is there for learning centre and so on and so forth. And we will, over time, I think, rotate the exhibits. But right now we haven't thought about that because April next year. One interesting thing, by the way, I was talking to a guy today about it. We hope to bring down a real outside broadcast van.
Oh, wow.
From ITV or the BBC, and have it parked outside the exhibition at the opening. We've located one, and we hope to be able to get it down.
Hear all the people at Cambridge. Well, all the art techies here, their ears have just pricked up at that one. They'll be down there.
Well, it will be a great triumph if we can achieve it, so we're working on that at the moment.
That sounds fascinating. Are there any holes in the collection? Because you've obviously amassed a huge amount of kit, but is there anything that you're looking for?
Product we'd love to have, which is pretty rare, is a Pi black box with the Chinese lacquer on it. Pi black box was one of the famous Pi record players, if you like.
Oh, right.
And the original one was a black one with Chinese lacquer on it. And it's really very rare, and we haven't got one. And if anybody listening has got one or knows of one and is prepared to loan it or even sell it, we'd be delighted to hear from them. We really would.
Excellent. All right, so there we are. If you've got one of those, go and check in the attic. Check in the attic now. If people want to get in touch with you, presumably there is a website for all this, and I would imagine that it's a great mine of information. Yes.
It's www.pimuseum.org. Get through to us from that, or you can email me if you want at rogercrabtree77 at gmail.com.
Fabulous.
Delighted to hear from anybody. If you've got any old documents, any old photos, or indeed any old products, let me know and we'll tell you whether or not they're of interest.
Well, this is amazing. Hopefully, I mean, as we said, Pi was such part of the Cambridge fabrics. Everyone around here knows somebody who worked at Pi or did
indeed
themselves.
Indeed, they do. Yeah.
And it's amazing what just gets kept in drawers. And you think, oh, that's never going to be of any use to anybody till you find it's the only one left. A handbook for something or whatever, or a news clipping or something like that.
We'd love to hear from you. We really would.
Excellent. Roger, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Well done to all of you at the Pi History Trust for what you've done. And it's going to be really exciting come next Easter when you're dedicated space at the new Museum of Technology opens, and we wish you luck, and we'll obviously speak many times, I hope, before then.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. That's Roger Crabtree. He's from the Pi History Trust. They're affiliated with the Museum of Technology. They've got a new permanent exhibition going in there when the museum opens up, which will be in the Easter, the spring of next year, and we'll keep you posted. And that website again was PiTrust.org?
PiMuseum.
I beg your pardon. PiMuseum.org. And Roger's email address, if you're driving along and you need it, just send us a text here in the studio and we'll forward you back out Roger's email address. Right, OK. Thank you very much indeed for that, Roger.